session number 18684, Reel 4.
Peter Bird, Reel 4.
We're showing the flag at Pola just because really the Yugoslavs didn't seem to understand that they were supposed to be on our side, you know, to be our allies. There was an army base there, and we invited them on board for drinks one evening, you know, after tying up there. And I noticed our gunnery officer, a warrant officer, and he was chatting up one of the army chaps who was a pilot of an Oster aircraft, and he was in the air spotting corps of spotting the fall of shot on the enemy and things like that. And Guns, our warrant officer, was fixing up to get a flight so that they could exercise our gyro sights on our guns as a dummy exercise for next morning. So I overheard this conversation, got very interested, and said, well, look, I've got a camera, because I didn't tell him it was just a brownie box camera, but I said, I've got a camera, and I'd like to photograph the ship from up above, if that's all right. So the army pilot said, well, sure, we'll send a car down 8 o'clock tomorrow morning and bring you to the airfield. And so we did this, you see, and I was the passenger at the back, and Guns was there. And if I may say so, he wasn't all that bright, because when we got up to 1,000 feet and the ship looked like a pencil alongside the dock, and the pilot said, well, now what do you want me to do? And the Guns said, well, fly down the port side of the ship. And so we did that. Well, that took all of 5 seconds, you see. And then the pilot said, well, what do you want me to do now? So Guns said, well, fly down the starboard side of the ship, you see. And that took another 5 seconds. So I leaned over to the pilot and said, our gunners have gyro sights and they're training on us for practice, you know, for the aim off, for speed, height and all the rest, for gyro. Oh, he said, why didn't you tell me? And he went into a steep dive, right down to the surface of the water. And he literally seemed to be about 10 feet off the water. He'd forgotten that with my extra weight, the plane would mush. And instead of just coming out smoothly out of the dive, we mushed. And that is to say, we went further down than he'd intended. And literally, we were about 10 feet off the water before we started taking up again. And then he went round and, as it were, attacked the ship from head on, or came round, attacked the ship from port side, and then coming from ahead, I noticed he tipped it. He didn't realize that our mast was 92 feet high. He had to tip his wing to miss the mast. And then down off the stern of the ship, he went along a buoyed channel in Pola Harbour, and we were actually looking up at the top marks of the buoys, which was quite a thrilling experience. He went round the back of an island and forgot there was a Bailey Bridge there joining it to the next island. So we missed that by about 6 feet, so it seemed. So it was really quite a hairy episode of giving some exercise to our guns crews. But by the same token, by the same experience, I gathered that this had a regular mail plane to Trieste. And so I said, look, if I get 7 days leave, I'll put in for it. Could you fly me up to Trieste? Oh, no bother at all. Come on the mail flight. You know, no trouble. So I went back to the ship, knocked off a smart salute to the captain, and said, may I have 7 days leave? Well, he thought I was mad. You know, what are you talking about? 7 days leave. I said, well, you know, you don't mind if I have 7 days leave. He said, no, but what are you going to do? I said, well, I've got it all lined up. So I next morning went to the army airport and got onto the mail plane. And the pilot was fretting a bit because an army officer who had come down on the morning flight had brought secret hand mail to the army headquarters there. It's just a little garrison, you see. And they were waiting for this chap to come back on the plane before we could set off. And we waited about 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and the pilot was saying, you know, I'm going to be late. And the jeep came with this chap, and he leapt on board, got in the seat, and I was sitting in the back. And we took off, and of course the Yugoslavs were firing at us as we went over their territory. This is why they didn't understand they were our allies, you see. But they were using rifle shots, so it didn't do any harm, it didn't hit us. And we set off for Trieste, which was 80 miles away. The passenger, this army officer, turned round and said, "Good God, it's Peter Bird." And I looked at him, I said, "Good God, it's Robin Scott." We'd both been in the same form together at school. And he lived on the farm at Neston, which is about 7 or 8 miles down the coast here. So we exchanged reminiscences, and he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm swanning up to Trieste, and then swanning up to Austria, you know, being peacetime." The two naval officers at Trieste I got to know quite well when we were up there. And so he said, "Well, are you going up to Klagenfurt?" And I said, "Yes, and hoping to." He said, "Well, Johnny Rudkin's there, another chap from school, you see." And so we got to Trieste. I met up with, as it happened, a naval dental officer that I knew quite well there. And the other officer, who's a great friend of mine now, he let us have a truck, a naval truck, on official business, going up to Klagenfurt. And so we went up to Klagenfurt and checked in to what the army had allocated as an officer's leave hotel. Once we got settled in, I picked up the telephone and I said to the operator, I said, "Are you 8th Army Signals?" He said, "Yes, sir." I said, "Can you contact Lieutenant John Rudkin?" He said, "Certainly, sir, I'll ring you back, sir." And 10 minutes later, we had Johnny Rudkin on the phone, who was at school here at the grammar school, saying, "Peter Bird, what on earth are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I'm with my friend here, Terry Knight, and we are swanning, you see." He said, "Come to dinner, to our mess, tomorrow night at Maria Werth, which is on the Wörthersee, a beautiful Austrian lake, of course." And so he sent a car for us, and we went down to his mess for dinner, for a more or less formal dinner. They were getting back to the idea of having Thursday night as a formal dinner. And his senior officer was a major, and we were sitting at the table with this major, and the Navy had put the major ashore in North Africa and had treated him rather well. And here he had two naval officers in uniform in his mess, you see, officer's mess, which he couldn't believe it. He said, "Well, that's amazing, having you chaps here." He said, "What are you doing?" And we said, "Well, we're really swanning, you know, we're hoping to get up into Austria, might even get to Vienna if we could, but we, you know, we have to hitchhike and things." "Oh," he said, "that's very interesting." "Oh," he said, "Rudkin, what about our generator?" "Oh, yes, sir." And they actually were sending a lorry towing a generator up to the Semmering Pass, you know, I think it's probably about 300 miles or something. And to cut a long story short, they were 8th Army Signals, and they were right on the Russian border, and were transmitting, you know, these Mickey Mouse's ears, army transmitter things, and they were in contact with their unit in Vienna, which was an open city. It had, you know, Russians, Americans, French, and ourselves. And these signals could then be relayed to the next station and right across Europe to the War Office. And they reckoned they were totally secure. And the Russians had a counter station on the next mountain trying to intercept, you know, but they were quite happy that they wouldn't. So we had this lorry and went up to Spital am Semmering, which is on the Semmering Pass, reported to Lieutenant in an inn. The headquarters was in the local inn. And next morning we went down to say, well, what can we do? You know, can we go any decent walks? I said, by the way, what have you got at the top of that mountain, Mount Stulek? And so he said, oh, that's our operating unit, but if you want to go up there, you're very welcome. So we changed, as it happened. We had rugby shorts and shirts. And he said, well, if you go out to ski run, you'll be there, I think, for 1 o'clock. So he picked up his telephone, which was connected to the top of the mountain, and said, Corporal Fletcher, 2 naval officers for lunch. And put his phone down. So immediate ring back. Say, what did you say, sir? He said, 2 naval officers for lunch. So, and we went up the ski run, and we actually got there by 11 in the morning, and not 1 o'clock as he'd estimated. And we had the old bully beef and carrots up on the top of the mountain. They showed us round. They showed us the Russian station on the opposite mountain, and. Next day, we went to report to this lieutenant again. He said, well, he said, it so happens I'm going through the Russian zone to Vienna. And he said, if you put your uniforms on, you can come with me as though you're on official business. So we did. We put our uniforms on, got in the jeep with him, and went to the Russian zone and officers through, and went to the Vienna woods, you know, went to his opposite unit in Vienna. It was a great experience. And back again to Spital, where they were accommodating us in a beautiful hunting lodge, which of course the army had commandeered, and that was the officers' leave hotel or something. And then we got looked after by a Dutch housekeeper and an Austrian maid. We'd taken the precaution of taking a suitcase full of tinned goods with us, and they took them down to the village and bartered, and we fed like lords. It was wonderful. And then, of course, we took the lorry driver, took us back to Klagenfurt, to return, because we had promised to return the lorry to him. And I rejoined the ship in Venice, in the Grand Canal in Venice. So here again, that was a tremendous experience, really. I think that's most of the things that happened to me.
So when were you demobbed?
1946. One of the next senior officer above me was demobbed from Trieste on Medlock, which is overland. With all your gear, you go by train back to the UK. And he lived in Wallasey. And I wrote to him and said, well, do tell me what's going on in Civvy Street. And he said in his letter reply that he'd tried to get into the medical school on an FETS grant, which is a further education training grant, government grant. But the medical school was full up, and he got a place in the dental school because they had one or two places left. So I wrote back by reply and said, stick me down too. And that's how it is that I joined the dental school in September 1946. Which was slightly before the end of my demob leave. In other words, it was continuous as I left the Navy and went into the dental school at the same time.
How do you feel now about having served in the Navy in the Second World War?
I have to confess that I loved it. I thought it was a fantastic service. I thought the discipline suited me very well indeed, but the skills of sailing and navigating and things appealed to me very much, having been brought up, of course, at the seaside as you have noted, and I've enjoyed the time in the Navy. You know, I never regretted a minute. Even the hard times were bearable to me, and I thought it was well worthwhile.
And you are RNVR?
RNVR, yes. I joined up as a sub-lieutenant, and of course I had my second ring as a lieutenant when I was on the frigate.